Professors FM.
Hey there, tax nerds. Before we dive into the episode, check out Fanalytics with Mike Lewis of Emory University. Like us, Mike breaks down complex topics, but for the world of sports. Explore player performance, fan loyalty, and even non-sports fandom. It's also a part of Professors FM, the podcast network making sense of the world with top scholars.
I'm Bridget Stomberg.
And I'm Lisa DeSimone.
And this is Taxes for the Masses.
Today's episode is on the tax consequences of music catalog sales.
2023 witnessed a number of musicians selling their music catalogs, including the likes of Justin Bieber, Pat Benatar, and Katy Perry, to name just a few. These sales come on the heels of other sales by Keith Urban, Stevie Nicks, and Bob Dylan. In this episode, we discuss the tax motivations for the rising trend of music catalog sales.
Hello, B.
It's me. Hi.
Okay, subtle. That's not usually how we open an episode, B.
You've got a good ear there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, but today, in honor of an episode about making money in the music industry, I figured we'd steal some lines from a woman who, let's just say, does that very well.
Ah, yes. Yes, she does. Mm-hmm. We are, of course, talking about Ms. Taylor Swift.
Tay-Tay.
And I didn't realize you were a fan, but I'm so glad that you're admitting that the problem is, in fact, you.
It is. I mean, no
it's
question.
About time.
No question there. I don't know if I want to say because of or in spite of your rendition of Shake It Off a couple years ago.
I made you a fan?
I don't know. Unclear.
That's what did it?
Unclear whether that's what drove me to it or whether that took me so long.
Turned you down the dark side?
Mm-hmm. How? Yeah.
Okay.
Unclear. Yeah, no, in all seriousness, I think I got serious about my Swiftie journey around the Super Bowl last year.
Interesting.
It is interesting.
She was not there to support her boyfriend last year.
No.
Because that wasn't a thing last
no.
year.
No. My kiddo found Blank Space somehow, and I listened to Blank Space about 9 million times in the
because
month of
your
February,
child.
Because of
not
my child.
Not because you loved it so much.
No, because of my child. And then, we rediscovered her again over the summer, coincidentally, and then went and saw her movie in October. So yes. I spent the entire months of September and October familiarizing myself with the Errors playlist.
And making friendship bracelets.
And making friendship bracelets.
Yes.
So it was good. It was great. And now I think I am a Swiftie.
I fully support that.
So are you a Swiftie?
I don't know that I'm a fanatic enough to be called a Swiftie. I like her.
Okay.
I'm a fan.
Yes.
I'm not a fanatic.
Okay.
And that's just because I haven't invested the time and resources that you have in her entire music catalog.
Yeah. I do think that once she started dating Travis Kelce, it kind of took it up a notch because it's I'm an NFL person. And,
yes.
And so, yeah, it may be all over my Instagram feed.
It made me finally understand who Travis Kelce was and why he was in so many commercials.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, well, today we are talking about the tax consequences of music catalog sales. And the reason that we're kind of framing this from a Taylor Swift perspective is because her tale of her music journey can actually help us set the stage a bit so that we can get the economics of the transaction out of the way.
Like it.
Talk a little bit about the money at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to get into the tax consequences of catalog sales, which could, it turns out, play a part in explaining the recent rise in catalog sales that we've seen.
This sounds awesome.
I think it's a
good topic.
Let's do this. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's kick it off. I close my eyes and the flashback starts.
Oh, yeah.
That was for you. When Taylor Swift came on the music scene in 2005, she signed her first contract with a company called Big Machine Records. And under the terms of that deal, Big Machine owned the original recordings, or what's called masters, of her first six albums.
And so legally speaking, what does that mean? Well, under U.S. copyright law, a music release includes a copyright to the original recording of the song, which, as you just said, is called the master. The owner of the master owns the copyright to all formats of that recording, including any digital versions that might be used for streaming.
Okay, and that means that whenever songs from Taylor's first six albums are played in commercials or, you know, played in a movie mm-hmm. as part of the soundtrack or in the background of a television show, royalties paid for using those songs go to Big Machine and not to Tay-Tay.
So Taylor signed that contract in 2005. Her contract was up in 2018.
That is a long contract.
It is. And this is another thing I understand that happens a lot of time to newbies.
Interesting.
So when her deal was up, she signed a new deal with a different company called Republic Records. Mm-hmm. Now, by this time, she was a certified music sensation / fearless leader / alpha type. And she could negotiate to retain the ownership rights to all of her future masters.
Killer.
Now, according to some sources, Swift tried to negotiate a purchase of the ownership rights from her first six albums from Big Machine at that time before her contract expired, but sadly, there was no deal.
That is sad.
Yeah. So she tried to get her masters, had the money to do it.
From what I understand, she tried pretty freaking hard.
Tried really hard. Rumor on the street is they said that they would sell her back one at a time for every new album she recorded for them.
I'm rolling my eyes.
No, thank you.
Yeah. In 2019, Big Machine was acquired by Ithaca Holdings LLC, which is a company owned by Scooter Braun. And even I have heard that name.
Yeah.
He's a music industry insider known for managing the likes of Justin Bieber and Kanye West. And he paid an estimated $330 million to acquire Big Machine and Swift's music catalog, which was roughly 80% mm-hmm. of Big Machine's revenue at the time.
Yeah.
He subsequently sold the masters in 2020 to Shamrock Holdings for $405 million. So he made a decent return on it, but Tay-Tay claims that she did everything she could to be the buyer instead. Begging, please don't go.
To no avail.
To no avail.
Yeah, so he made a cool, what is that, if I can do the math, $75 million in a year.
In a year.
That's nice.
Yeah. Okay, this all raises a reasonable question.
I hope so.
Why would a private equity firm want to own a music catalog?
That is a good question.
And the answer?
You got it. You know this.
To make money. Music catalogs are an income producing asset. And that's what private equity firms are in the business of acquiring. They want to acquire businesses that produce income.
Yes.
And our sharp-eared listeners may recall our episode on private equity firms buying up the real estate rental market.
Yes.
For the exact same reason. Yes, it's a bunch of income producing assets.
Steady stream.
So music catalogs have become a valuable asset class because of the royalty income that they generate.
All right. So just to make sure we've got our terms defined, royalties are payments to owners of intellectual property, like copyrighted music, for their use. Currently, one of the most ubiquitous royalty sources comes from streaming.
Uh-huh.
Spotify announced that they have paid out over $40 billion in royalties to the music industry in exchange for the rights to offer artists songs for streaming.
Plus, there's income from sampling or using songs in movies or on TV.
Yep.
Sean Diddy Combs famously tweeted that he pays Sting $5,000 a day for sampling Every Breath You Take for the smash hit I'll Be Missing You. And that song has generated an estimated $20 million in royalties for Sting.
One song.
One song.
Being sampled by another person.
Yes.
$20 million for Sting.
Yes.
You can see that these dollars are starting to add up.
It is a great song, though. I mean, if Diddy can mm-hmm. sample it, you know what I mean. You know what I'm talking about.
Do I?
He doesn't have to rhyme. He pays the bills.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's understandable that Tay-Tay and other musicians would like to own the masters of their songs. After Big Machine sold her masters, Swift got tired of waiting, wondering if the masters were ever coming around. But she didn't get sad. She got even. Following the advice of Kelly Clarkson, I just love this story.
It's so good.
Swift has begun re-releasing her first six albums as new recordings that she owns the masters to.
And she can legally do that because even though she doesn't own the copyrights to those original recordings, she does own the publishing rights. The rights to the lyrics, to the melody, etc. So when Cousin Richie sings Love Story,
Taylor's version,
in season two of The Bear, which, by the way, if you haven't watched it and I'm talking to you, you need to get your priorities straight in life.
I mean, you're not talking to me because I've seen it twice.
Loved it.
Yes.
Possibly the best moment of TV in 2023. There, I said it.
It's possible.
It's a scene, people. Tay-Tay was entitled to any royalties earned during that scene, which is just so good.
Just go watch it.
And was able to control how the show used her song, which was in an amazing character arc. Mm-hmm. All right. Creative control is just this other incentive to own your masters so that your song doesn't end up as the background music in a commercial you don't approve of instead of being sung by Cousin Richie.
No, so I don't know if you know this.
Hmm?
Violent Femmes.
Yeah.
You familiar with them?
Yeah, yeah.
Blister in the Sun?
Yeah.
Apparently, they broke up temporarily after one band member, to the chagrin of another, agreed to let Wendy's use their song, Blister in the Sun, as background in a fish sandwich commercial.
Oh, my God. So many thoughts. All right. So we've decided that you probably want to own the masters.
Correct.
But I'm a little confused now because we've just argued that this is such a great thing to own.
Yes.
Why are we seeing so many artists sell them?
It's all about the taxes, baby.
It is a love story.
Just say yes. Okay, we know that music copyrights are valuable because they can generate a lot of royalty income.
Okay.
Let's now talk about why the tax treatment of these royalty payments might be motivating some artists to offload their music catalogs to corporations and private equity firms.
Are you ready for it? I am. All right, so for this to all make sense, we need to talk about the character of income under the U.S. tax code.
Ooh, fancy.
Income has one of two characters. It is either ordinary or it is capital. Since this distinction came into existence around 100 years ago, ordinary income has typically been taxed at higher rates than capital income. And right now, the highest tax rate on ordinary income is 37% at the federal level, plus state, if mm-hmm. you're in a taxed state. Whereas the highest tax rate on capital income is around 24% at the federal level, once you add the net investment income tax that applies to high-income individuals who would have to pay that rate. So tell me, B, do you remember learning how to distinguish ordinary from capital income?
I remember it all too well.
Oh, dear.
For those who were forced to read the tax code to learn this distinction, like I was, it's truly terrible.
Okay.
In a nutshell, income is ordinary unless it's capital.
Oh, that's logical.
Very helpful. Very descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
And for income to be capital, generally you have to sell a capital asset.
Sure.
Code section 1221 defines a capital asset, and it does so in the most infuriating way. It defines it negatively.
That's right. So code section 1221 defines a capital asset by defining what is not a capital asset.
So helpful.
Very helpful. Historically, a capital asset was anything that was not ordinary income property, like inventory held for sale.
Do you feel like we're just on a hamster wheel here?
Yeah, a little bit. The general idea, though, is that Congress wants a higher tax rate on trade or business activity, things that you do day to day to earn a living. And we want to reserve a preferential lower capital gains rate for investment activity. And so we're trying to distinguish between assets that are used for day-to-day trade yep. business type purposes versus those that are used for investing.
Okay, absolutely. But the definition of a capital asset is murky at best.
Agreed.
Has been that way for a long time.
Yes.
Some might even say that the definition is arbitrary.
If you say so.
And it changes a lot. So for example, courts generally held that only works created by professionals would be taxed at ordinary rates, whereas works created by amateurs would be considered capital assets and their sale would be taxed at lower rates. And the reasoning was that creative works of professionals were more like business inventory than the creative works of an amateur.
Okay, it actually makes some sense to me.
It kind of does.
Yes.
It kind of does, but keep reading.
Okay. In the 1950s, then General Dwight D. Eisenhower sold his World War II memoirs called Crusade in Europe for the equivalent of $8 million in today's dollars.
That's a lot of dollars.
That's a lot of dollars.
That's a lot of dollars.
He obtained an advance ruling from the U.S. Treasury that his earnings from the sale would be taxed at the capital gains rate because he was an amateur, not a professional writer.
Okay.
That ruling saved him over $5 million in today's dollars.
What?
Yes. And if that math is making your head spin, it's because the top U.S. federal rate in the 1950s was, wait for it, 91%.
What is going on?
Yes, 91. Yeah. So good move, Ike. Nice tax planning.
Such a good move. that it prompted Congress to amend the definition of a capital asset to specifically exclude all self-created copyrights and musical compositions, regardless of whether the seller was an amateur or a professional. So that logic that you liked, gone.
I didn't say I liked it. I just said that I could see some logic to it.
Okay, gone.
Okay.
And that's how things stayed for about 50 years.
So that brings us to the early aughts. The Nashville Songwriters Association International, whose name seems like a contradiction in terms. They started lobbying Congress to pass legislation that would give songwriters capital gains treatment for their song sales. And the organization justified this request with pleas for vertical equity, which is the goal of any good tax policy that strives to make sure that those making more income pay more tax. And vice versa, those making less income pay less tax.
Okay, so the executive director of this Nashville Songwriters Association International said it was only fair to tax songwriters' income from music sales at lower rates because their average annual income was below $5,000. And that was the vertical equity argument. These songwriters are making less money, so we should tax them less.
Okay, but if their average annual income was below $5,000, that would mean they're below the standard deduction and they wouldn't even be filing tax returns in the first place.
Shh, you're ruining the good lobbying argument.
Sorry. The other argument that they had was about neutrality. So many songwriters partner with a publishing business, and upon the sale of their songs, the music publisher would receive capital gains treatment on their investment, whereas the musician would be forced to pay ordinary income rates on the sale of their quote-unquote inventory.
So once again, a tax policy that is marketed as helping the little guy who's making only $5,000 a year, it actually winds up benefiting people like Bob Dylan and Stevie Nicks, who I think are making more than $5,000 a year.
I love Stevie Nicks, though.
Who doesn't love Stevie Nicks?
All right. So let's recap. So before 2006, if a musician collected royalties on a song they owned, those royalties were taxed at ordinary income rates. And if instead a musician sold their song to, say, a music publisher, the gain on that sale was taxed at ordinary income rates.
Now, assuming the amounts received by the musician exceeded the standard deduction, to your point, such that they were required to file a tax return, that's all true. So continue.
Okay. Now, after 2006, Congress, they once again changed the definition of a capital asset.
After the lobbying by this Nashville group.
Okay. So now, if a musician collects royalties on a song they own, those royalties are still taxed at ordinary income rates. But if instead a musician sells their song to, say, a music publisher or private equity firm, the gain on that sale is now taxed at capital gains tax rates.
Assuming they held the rights to the song for more than a year, so it was long-term capital gain, yes, continue.
By changing the definition of a capital asset, thanks to successful lobbying, musicians can now have the opportunity to engage in what we call conversion. So it's a conversion tax planning strategy. They convert their income from ordinary to capital in character in order to save taxes.
So let's do a simple example. In 2020, Stevie Nicks sold an 80% stake in her songwriting catalog to a music producer for an estimated $100 million. Ignoring the time value of money, if Nicks had received the amount in royalties, she would have owed about $37 million in U.S. federal tax.
I agree.
But if this amount is taxed as the sale of a capital asset, she would only owe $23.8 million in federal tax. That's nearly $14 million of taxes saved on a $100 million sale. I mean, either way, she winds up with over $60 million, so champagne problems.
Expensive champagne to boot.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said $23.8 million would be the max amount that, of tax that she'd owe, because first, that simple little calculation assumes she has no basis in her songs. Fair enough. It also assumes she doesn't have any capital losses lurking around that could offset those gains. And so these numbers that we've thrown out are the max.
Max. Okay. Excellent point. Okay, so of course there are plenty of non-tax reasons for artists to sell their music catalog, especially in recent years. We started to see an uptick in these big sales around the start of the pandemic in 2020, when it was basically impossible to tour, and that in and of itself cut off a revenue stream for some artists.
Got it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, people weren't going to concerts in 2020.
Yeah.
All right. There's also the fact that streaming has become a little bit more stable, and private equity firms are able to better forecast investment returns and appropriately price an artist's collection.
So I say tis the damn season for music catalog sales.
Baby, just say yes.
Okay, time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I will start with a good by saying this is a fun episode.
Yeah, super fun.
Yeah, so I don't think we've done one on taxes and music before.
No, we should have. We've referenced a ton of songs across numerous podcasts.
So here you go.
Mostly Taylor Swift and Beyonce, but not exclusively. Yeah, not exclusively.
Here it is, listeners, the episode you didn't even know you wanted.
Yes.
But you did.
Yes.
Okay, what you got?
I also like that this is going to pair really nicely with our episode on Shohei Ohtani's contract with the Dodgers.
Say more things.
Because that tax planning strategy is all about timing.
Yes.
And today we talked about tax strategies all about conversion of character of income. Yes. And these are two of the biggest dials that you can turn in tax planning.
Absolutely. Yes. Anything bad to talk about here?
I think the hoops we had to jump through to define a capital asset my favorite. This is why I don't even try to define it in any technical way in my classes.
No, just no.
It's just generally investment assets and income from investment assets.
Yep.
Yeah. And the carve out that we're talking about today is, of course, the exception to the exception.
Yes, this self-created music sale thing. Yeah, you gotta read deep into the code to get there.
To get there, yeah. And so this code section it's just trouble. The whole thing is just trouble. The original one, defining capital assets, it's an evolution over time, hasn't made it that much better. It's a hot mess.
You knew it was trouble when it walked in.
I did.
Okay. And also, let's talk about the fact that not only is it confusing, it's changed pretty substantially two times in the last 50 years, seemingly based on Congress's mood that day.
And lobbying. Our favorite change laws.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, we're mad at Dwight D. Eisenhower because he got an advance ruling. Right. We're happy with the Nashville Musicians Songwriters Association because they're lining our pockets. Yeah, it's just kind of crazy. So there's a possibility that we could see another change in the rule, because I'm gonna go right to the ugly here.
Bring it.
Okay, so another fun point on this fact.
Yes.
Like you said, this is an exception to an exception. Yes. So self-created works of musical art.
Yes.
When you sell those, you can get this capital gain treatment. But self-created patents and other types of self-created intellectual property used to also be treated as capital assets.
Used to be.
But our favorite, the TCJA.
Oh dear.
Yes, did away with that exception. So now the code section is written such that the creator of a song is taxed differently when they sell that song than, let's say, the creator of a video game is when they sell that video game.
I'm giving you confused face because I am confused.
Because it makes no flipping sense.
Was this an intentional policy for the TCJ, or is this one of those oopsies?
You know, I'm thinking it's another one of those oopsies. It's got to be.
I'm struggling to come up with the rational reason for passing this policy.
Maybe it's lobbying again. Maybe they had to put some stuff on the chopping block, and maybe the Nashville Songwriters Association dug deep and managed to preserve this exception for the music industry where these video game nerds didn't do it.
Nerds. I'm going to point out another ugly here, which is that there's kind of this dark side to these changing policies to these tax planning opportunities.
Okay.
The argument by the lobbying group was help the little
$5,000
a year who aren't even filing a tax return.
Right. Shh.
And meanwhile, Bob Dylan and Stevie Nicks are... I'm not going to say what they're doing.
No, and I was going to say, or you could talk about Willie Nelson, because he's not filing a tax return either.
I think he learned his lesson. I think he's filing. He has the best accountant in Texas, I guarantee you.
I'm glad.
Please, Willie, say it's true.
So lots of stuff going on here, but I want to end on a serious note. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite Taylor Swift song?
Ooh. Yeah. Yes. The one next door. It's the I'm wearing sneakers.
You belong to me.
You gotta cut that. Oh my God!
No,
we got her to sing.
No,
yes.
No,
and yours. Please sing it.
So again, we're just gonna display our differences. I like all the sad.
Of course you do.
T Swift songs, and so I think right now it's Cardigan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay.
Can I get a line from Cardigan?
Well, I'll say it. My favorite line is, when you are young, they assume you know nothing.
They would be right.
Okay.
Well, that's all we have time for today.
Be sure to join us for more tax nerdery on future episodes of Taxes for the Masses.